كبيرا.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Muhammad is not the father of any of your men, but he is the messenger of Allah and the seal of the prophets, and Allah has full knowledge of all things. O you who believe, celebrate the praises of Allah and do so often, and glorify him morning and evening. He it is who sends blessings on you, as do his angels, that he may bring you out from the depths of darkness into light. And he is full of mercy to the believers. Their salutation on the day they meet him will be peace, and he has prepared for them a generous reward. O Prophet, truly we have sent thee as a witness, a bearer of glad tidings and a warner, and as one who invites to Allah's grace by his leave, and as a lamp spreading light. Then give the glad tidings to the believers, that they shall have from Allah a very great bounty. Sadaqallahu al-Azim.
MashaAllah, that was excellent. Thank you, Abdul Wahab and Ahmed Khawaja. Brothers and sisters, welcome to the launch of Brother Zafar's latest book, Power Manifestations of the Seerah, examining the letters and the treaties of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. It is a new approach to studying the Seerah, and of course we will hear about it over the course of tonight's program. We have an excellent list of speakers for you tonight. In the past, we kept Imam Muhammad al-Asi to the end of the program, and unfortunately he's never gotten enough time to speak, so tonight we will be beginning with him. You all know that Imam al-Asi is... Sorry, you all know who Imam al-Asi is. We have his book sitting right at the front of the table here. He is a fellow at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought and is best known for his remarkable tafsir, as I pointed out at the front here. The Ascendant Quran is the title of this book. Copies of the tafsir are available here. 4 volumes have been published, mashallah, and the 5th is in press. We would like to welcome now Imam Muhammad al-Asi.
الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي أنزل علينا قرآنا نقرأه اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق لا مبدل لكلماته فيه شفاء للناس لو أنزلنا هذا القرآن على جبل لرأيته خاشعاً متصدعاً من خشية الله وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله بارئ الخلائق أجمعين وأشهد أن إمامنا ومعصومنا وولي أمرنا ومولانا محمدًا صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم عبده ورسوله Dear brothers and dear sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته I would like to begin by thanking the hosts of tonight's event by placing me up front, thereby trying to satisfy you and me that they are giving me extra time, where it's only half an hour, whether I'm up front or at the end of the list, it doesn't matter. I'll try to add a few other minutes without being inconsiderate of the other speakers who will follow me. The first remark I have to make in this very limited time frame is that the seerah of Allah's Prophet is not a very easy subject to write about. I remember many years ago, I can't remember how many years ago, but they must have been in the area of maybe 15 to 20 years, that Brother Zafar had mentioned to me that he would like to have, in addition to the work on a tafsir, some type of input into the crescent pertaining to the seerah. And I remember trying to politely decline his offer, simply because as much as work on the seerah is needed, it's simply, I think, of a magnitude that exceeds even working on the Qur'an. And here we're not trying to draw comparisons or trying to make a judgment. The matter is very simple. The ayat of the Qur'an, the 6,000 and few hundred plus ayat of the Qur'an, are there. You know these ayat. Every Muslim in the world knows these ayat. They begin in the order of the Qur'an that we have today, from Surah Al-Fatiha and Al-Baqarah and Ali Imran, and then they end with Al-Mu'awwidhatayn, or Qul Huwa Allahu Ahad, and Qul A'udhu Bi Rabbil Falaq, and Qul A'udhu Bi Rabbil Nas. Everything in between are the ayat of the Qur'an. There's nothing dubious about them. There's nothing argumentative about them. These are the ayat of the Qur'an, finished. What is left up to us is to put our minds to work and understand what these ayat mean in the context and in the world that we are in. So let's get on with the task, as demanding as that may be. Now, when you want to deal with the seerah of Allah's Prophet, here you have another dynamic at work that is sometimes very elusive, because the hadiths of the Prophet, or the works, the historical books that we have inherited of the Prophet's lifetime, call it seerah, call it sunnah, it's your call. But when you come to this body of literature, you get into something that is sahih, and something that is da'if, and something that is hasan, and something that is manhul, and something that is questionable, and on and on and on. So who's going to sort this out? Good luck, Brother Zafar, if you're thinking about following up the work that you are doing, because it really demands much more. I think, this is my personal and humble comment on this, this is a task that demands a consolidated effort of pooling the minds of the Muslims together from the different historical contexts that they refer to, from the different bodies of hadith that has become their references, etc., etc. And this, you know, when you think about it objectively, it is beyond one individual's efforts. Nevertheless, that being said, Brother Zafar had gone ahead and worked his way, I think, in an admirable manner, and put together, I think, a contribution to the seerah books and the seerah literature that we have, all of us. And I think, I haven't read the book from page to page, but I looked through it, and I think he did an admirable job in as far as being fair to the subject matter without isolating or alienating the different types of historical and fiqhi and hadith categorizations that we have been born into. Not many of us take the mental time off to think our way through the traditions that we were born into. This, I think, will help the average Muslim, regardless of your background or your miniature cultures, regardless of all of those, this is, I think, a very helpful and a very thankful work that we are here to celebrate, in a sense. Okay, now, let me try to give you a sense of, I just said in general, what I'm going to try to break down now more specifically. When we look at the seerah of Allah's Prophet, we scanned through the different books, and there's plenty of them, even though they don't concentrate on the particular issue of power and authority. This is one subject matter that has been left out of the writings of our respected scholars in the past, and even up until very recently, where no one is very much interested in thinking about the Prophet's decisions when they pertain to issues of power in society. And I'm going to have to break this down, because many times I've been a listener like you, and I've heard some speakers speak about the issue of power, and many times it appears to me that it eludes, the issue of power eludes the average listener, as sincere and as anxious as the listener is to understand, what are you trying to say here? I mean, I'm listening, but I'm there's no traction. And I want traction. Excuse me. So to try to put this in a way that you can understand it a little more, I'm going to be very simplistic. And I'm going to say, if there is an insect, let's pick on a mosquito. If there's a mosquito around you, and that mosquito doesn't like you, or that fly or mosquito actually hates you. Thank you very much. How concerned are you? Are you going to sweat because a mosquito is buzzing around and the mosquito really hates you? I don't think so. I don't think you'd even give it a second thought, knowing that the mosquito hates you very much. But it just doesn't register. The mosquito goes about trying to draw a little of your blood, and it goes on its happy way, and you go on your happy way, and nothing has registered. But let's go from a mosquito to, let's say, a rabid animal. A cat or a dog or a raccoon or something like that. And that animal really hates you. Now, at this point, you are going to think, hey, that animal could attack me and might begin to bite my leg and take maybe a little chunk of skin out of my body. So right here now, that caught your attention. You go from a simple insect to a simple animal, and then you go from a simple animal to a very sophisticated human being, a thinking human being with evil on its mind. And that human being also hates you. He hates you in the depth of his guts. But he doesn't appear that way. He shields this hostility that is raging on inside of him. He camouflages all of that with a smile, with a friendly approach. Now, in In presenting these three examples, the variable that exists between the first, the insect, the mosquito, and let's say the rabid dog, the difference is a difference of power. A mosquito doesn't have power. It's on, in its own way, it's in a defensive mode. It just wants a little of your blood, and it goes on its merry way. And so you're not concerned, because there's no power there. But when it comes to an animal beyond the simple animal, a mosquito, you're looking at harm that is going to be done to you. So here, your antenna goes up, and you're alert. You want to be safe. You want to preserve your life and your dignity. So that difference, and the factor, the psychological factor is the same. Both these animals hate you. And they want to work their nature against you. And then when you come to this, the most sophisticated form of life, which is your fellow human being who's around, who also may harbor this intense animosity and hostility inside, but is very well qualified to camouflage it inside of him, then you should be more than vigilant, lest that person harm you, not you only as a person, but could harm your collective human presence in this world. This is the issue of power. And take this, just consider what I just told you like seeds that I'm throwing out into your thinking capacity. Take this with you next time when you hear someone speaking about power, then understand power is really an issue that we live with. The systems, the establishments around may have the capacity to disguise it. They don't want you to feel what's going on. When they use the soft power, the vicious power, whatever power they use in getting at you, undermining you, annihilating you in their own ways. Now, when we take a look at this, we go back to the Prophet's time. And let's assume the Mecca that we are speaking about, this is where Islam began, where the Quran was revealed, where the Prophet was born, where the first contact of this heavenly message began its social struggle. Let's assume there was no power presence in Mecca. Abu Jahl and Abu Lahab and Abu Sufyan and the rest of the Abus, they had no power. Who would be concerned? Just like that mosquito that we were talking about. Oh, they don't have any power, so who cares? We can go about speaking about these ayat and the Prophet quoting his hadiths. Everything would be normal. But we know that wasn't the case. Nothing was normal. Why wasn't it normal? Why didn't the people of Mecca, in their power structure and their power heritage, why did they not let the Prophet just say what was on his mind? Because there was an issue of power. They knew if they were to give the liberty and freedom to this person called Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, if they were to give him that freedom of expression and freedom of conscience and freedom of communication, then something is going to happen to their power structure. And therefore, they were not going to let that happen. And was the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his, was he aware of this? Of course he was aware of this. And if he was aware of this, then that means we can begin to read and to understand and to consider his lifelong jihad or his seerah in light of this fact. So when these words came to him from heaven, beginning with اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق and يا أيها المدثر قم فأنذر, when these initial ayat were revealed to him, he understood that this is going to be an issue of powers that are conflicting with each other. The first integral component of this power contention is al-wahdaniyya. All of us say tawheed, or all of us say wahdaniyya. These are words that we all use. Unfortunately, we don't use them in the power context that we are speaking about here. Because the message that has come from Allah throughout prophetic history was that power and authority belong to Allah. There can be no human being who claims that he or she, as an individual, or as a party, or as a government, or as a ruling class, or as a political orientation, none of them have the right to claim that they are the power of the land and the law of the land. This is an issue that makes for wars. And so the Prophet understood this from the first communication that he received from on high. This is an issue of tawheed and wahdaniyya, and therefore these people now who enjoy positions of power and authority are going to lose those positions. That was a very elementary, a very essential component of this new message that now has arrived in the Mecca of that time and of that place. Another important component that generates a lot of hostilities from people who have wealth and have status and have power is that this message of Islam seems to equalize people, regardless of your race, regardless of your social status, regardless of your ethnic background, regardless of your gender, regardless of all of these other divisive issues that are around. Unlike the world of discrimination and prejudice and class conflict and all of this, this message harmonizes people together. So that person who had that position of power and looks down at the other person who is trivial or who is powerless, that's going to go. And that is perceived as a threat. So not only the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his, not only did he understand that, but also those people who were in positions of power, the elites of Mecca, they understood that too. So here, from the beginning, there is a power clash that has not been worked out very clearly and very accurately in the resources or the references of our history. So that now it's left up to us today to try to take a closer look at this. And in doing so, we find out that in the first 3 years of the Prophet's lifelong jihad, These were years of secrecy. Now you may ask, why should there be secrecy? And the simple answer is, it's a power answer, because he's dealing with a power establishment that feels threatened because of the content and the nature of the wahi that was being revealed to this person from on high. And the Prophet, what began this secret phase of his seerah, he began it without first having a power confrontation with his potential enemies. He began to communicate these words of the Quran. He began to communicate them to the immediate people around him in secret. This means, this is a very, if you think about it, if someone today is going to begin to do something away from the public eye, it means it is something very important and it's something very dangerous. Dangerous not in the sense that it is detrimental to its adherents. Dangerous in the sense that it is a lethal development that will take on the established power structure around. So before the potential adversaries of the Prophet would show their true colors, the Prophet began his communication of this Quran and this Islam away from the public eye. The communication and the organization at the same time. Both of these were not left to the people who were around to know that they were happening. Now, how did he begin this? Did he just, in what today is called the liberal mind, he just go out there and say, wait a minute, I'm just going to, you know, talk to anyone out there who's willing to listen? Or did he practice his better judgment in trying to identify individuals who would be positively and faithfully committed to what he is going to tell them? And reading through these books of seerah, you will find that he selectively, using his better judgment, chose on selective individuals to disclose to them what this Islam means, what this Quran is saying, what is meant by revelation from God to man. And you see, it turns out that when he did that, he didn't do this in a discriminatory manner. He was selective, but not discriminatory. Who did he choose? The first one that we know of to have been apprised of this revelation was Sayyida Khadija, his wife Khadija. And then his cousin, who was still very young, Ali ibn Abi Talib. And then his mawla, Zayd ibn Haritha. And then his best friend, Abu Bakr as-Siddiq. These were the first individuals who were favored by Allah's Prophet, by Allah's Prophet's confidence to receive the meanings of this message from heaven to mankind. And then along the way, in the dynamics of the months that followed, We're still within that three-year, I don't want to use the word clandestine because it, you know, you begin to think in other areas. And I also would like not to use the word underground, even though it comes more to capturing the meaning of that stage or that phase. But when it came to this organization or organizing away from the public eye, in addition to these individuals, we had some others who also joined this effort early on. And those are some others. I'm not going to be exhaustive here, but I'm just going to mention a few names. And most of them came because of the influence that Abu Bakr had within his circle of friends. One of them was Uthman ibn Affan. The other one was Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas. Another one was Abdul Rahman ibn Auf. And then throughout these 3 years, because of this power consciousness of what's at work here, there was about 50 or 50 plus a few individuals who joined Allah's Prophet. 3 years of not going public with this message won over around 50 dedicated individuals to this Prophet and his message. And when we take a look at these 50 individuals, we find that they come from, you see, you have to have a little impression of the tribal makeup of Mecca. Tribalism in those days was like, in today's world, there's no tribalism. When you think of yourself, you don't think of yourself, hey, I belong to a certain tribe. What has substituted for tribe in our time is the issue of nationality. What nationality are you? So when we say tribalism in those times, it's like saying in today's world, what nationality are you? Or in some instances, depending on the society we're speaking about, it could be what race you belong to. So it's not like saying tribalism is something primitive. When we use the word tribalism in Mecca 1400 years ago, it doesn't have its equivalent meaning in today's world. It does. So when in those 3 years, when the Prophet of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, when he thought through this power configuration or the power world that he and we are living in, he managed to bring from the major national or power configurations of Mecca, bring them together. From Bani Hashim, even though Ali ibn Abi Talib was the only one from Bani Hashim in those formative years to have come into the Prophet's inner circle. In addition to that, there were people from Bani Taim, individuals from Bani Asd, individuals from Bani Umayyah, individuals from Bani Zuhra. These were like power centers inside Mecca that came into the fold of the Prophet. In other words, they relinquished their tribal character now and they gained a new social character. They became Muslims. They became committed Muslims. And we see also that some of their wives, because one issue that is left out of much of Sira literature is the issue of gender. But here, if we take a look at these first 50 or so individuals who became the committed core of Islam, we find that some of them had their wives with them. They were in this circle. Who's not saying, oh, you know, you can't have your wife, or she's a Muslimah, or she can't, you know, attend any meet. No, these wives were going to Dar al-Arqam ibn Abi al-Arqam, where they were forced to have meetings. Because one of the factors in a seerah that also is not very much highlighted is that these Muslims who were building themselves up in an organizational manner, the Prophet was the leader, the Prophet was the imam, so to speak. They were forced to meet in Dar al-Arqam ibn Abi al-Arqam when people outside who were not Muslims began to sense, hey, something's going on here. On occasions, they would see the Prophet and his cousin praying in the haram. Now, the prayers at this time were not as-salah al-maktuba or al-mafruza. The salah that we pray today, al-fajr, al-dhuhr, al-asr, al-maghrib, al-isha, that wasn't around. The salah at those times were only two raka'at. That's all they were, two raka'at in the morning and two raka'at at night. But they began to see that these prayers are somewhat different from the prayers that they are performing. So, without the Muslims intending, the public, the social eye now of Quraysh and Mecca began to sense something is going on here. At one time, in one of the Shi'ab of Mecca, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas was with some of these committed Muslims. He was confronted with some of the average individuals of Mecca who questioned, what are you doing here? What's this salah that doesn't totally agree with our salah? What's going on? Is something going on? So they wanted to probe this dynamic that was left away from their attention. And then an altercation began. And this was the first time someone bled in this, as of yet, not accomplished power confrontation between two sides and two opposing camps. As a result of that, these committed Muslims decided to meet in Dar al-Arqam ibn Abi al-Arqam, away from the intruding and the suspecting eye of the Meccans. In these dynamics, and there's plenty of them that are at work here, there is what is called al-jiwar or al-himaya. Meaning that if a person from Bani Hashim, like the Prophet and Ali, these two persons belong to Bani Hashim because of that tribal setup of Mecca. And it was the norm of that time, or you can say, there were no courts in Mecca, there was no legal system, but you can say, if we wanted to take the world of that time and try to place it in the world of our time, we could say the law of the land there required that a tribe protect one who belongs to it from others. So it was a responsibility of Bani Hashim and the responsibility of Bani Abdul Muttalib to protect Muhammad and to protect Ali. It was responsibility of Bani Taym, which was the least of the power factions in this tribal setup, to protect Abu Bakr. It was responsibility of others to protect their own if they were threatened by the others. This protection, the Prophet of Allah did not say, annul it. He didn't say, we don't want your protection. As long as they were willing to protect him, he was accepting of that. He accepted that. That's why he lived out that tradition. It finally ran out of steam when they decided one day that we've had enough with this person, and all of these tribal factions met and said, this is a way we're going to solve this growing problem. This was after around 13 years of this struggle in Mecca. Said, okay, all of us are going to meet and all of us are going to go to this person's house, and each one, we're going to pick each one from us to come down with his sword on his body, and therefore his blood, this is in their own words, his blood is going to be dispersed among all our power factions. Therefore, not one tribe is going to be responsible for the assassination of Muhammad, alayhi salatu wassalam. That's how they dealt with this issue. But before it reached that climax, the Prophet didn't see any problem with taking advantage of or exhausting the laws of those lands that were protective of his right, in today's world, his human right, his civic right, and his political right to express himself. In today's world, we have people who stumble. Man, these are sincere Muslims and they've read a lot and they're anxious to do what is right and all this. But they stumble and they can't see if there are laws in certain lands that are working for them. Okay, fine. Let these laws work for you. Because before and after all of this, this remains a power issue. And another component that is not very much highlighted in the books of Sirah is the component of the youth. Allah's Prophet gave certain responsibilities to youth, to young people. This is not highlighted. Al-Imam Ali was very young. Aisha was very young. Usama ibn Zayd ibn Haritha was very young. And there are other individuals in this history who assumed military, scholarly, civic duties when they were very young. Even people who, in the normal course of things, would be excluded from some responsibilities, in the time of Allah's Prophet, were given responsibilities. When the Prophet of Allah used to leave Al-Madinah, he used to deputize someone to be in charge of Al-Madinah. And we know from the books of Sirah that was a blind person, Ibn Ummi Maktoum. The Prophet put a blind person to be in charge of Al-Madinah when he's gone. And when the rest of the able-bodied Muslims were on a military mission. That challenges some of the conventional traditions that many Muslims have, that, no, wait a minute, let's exempt this person because, you know, he's handicapped or something like that. And this person was also, I don't like to deal with this issue in a sense, because it throws into your mind misunderstanding. And that is, I'm going to use the word, but please don't think of this as coming from the political and ideological background that it is used within. The word is class, social class. The upper class, the middle class, the lower class. When we take a look, a very close look at the seerah of Allah's Prophet, we find that the message of Islam was presented to everyone regardless of their class. And there are social laws at work, sunan, social laws, sunan, sunna, a social law. قَدْ خَلَتْ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ سُنَنْ. Preceding you are matters of social laws. So why can't we learn? The Prophet of Allah, he presented this, as I said, without discrimination, without bias. He presented this message to whomever he thought will be responsibly receptive to it. And when he did that, when we take a look at, let's say, the first 50 or so characters who joined him in this immense effort, we see that most of them come from what we call today the middle class. It wasn't because it was engineered to be that way. It was because this was the way society would itself respond to it. This doesn't mean everyone in the middle class is hunky-dory, as it were. Everyone in the middle class is fine and dandy. No. And it doesn't mean that the other extremes, whether it's the upper class or the lower class, are excluded. There were people in this group of 50, there were people from the upper class. Uthman ibn Affan was from the upper class. Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas was from the upper class, wearing a gold ring, putting on elaborate clothes. So was Abdurrahman ibn Auf. And there were those who were from the lower class. Like we said, Ibn Ummi Maktoum, Zayd, Mawla Rasulillah, meaning Zayd ibn Haritha, Ayman, Bilal, and others. And there's something in this social law that helps us out if we can identify. Because come to think about it, when you look at the upper and lower classes, we're not trying to be unfair to them. We're just trying to be as objective as we can. When people come from affluent and very wealthy families and backgrounds, the majority of them, not all of them, the majority of them are spoiled. That's the word you can use. They're spoiled. They sort of don't have the backbone that is required to stay with this struggle and with this jihad until what is called the bitter end. Not all of them. There are some people who do come from that background. And they try their best to do however much they can. Likewise, those who come from the lower classes, many of them, not all of them, I have to reiterate and repeat this, because sometimes people, they just want to draw quick conclusions. Don't. It's a little tricky. But those who come from the lower classes, many of them, their spirits are broken. They just don't have the motivation and the marathon spirit to go with this until the bitter end. In this coagulation of the human effort around Allah's Prophet, we find that those who come from mid-society were the ones who carried the responsibilities that later on withstood the test of time. Now, some of us can skip this history and go beyond the Prophet and think about what happened in the years beyond that. We don't have time for that right now. Let's concentrate on the years of the Prophet and learn from what he said and from what he did. One of the important, I'll try to end it with this, I know over here, some individuals may be getting a little nervous. But one of the features of looking at the seerah is many times we tend to quote what the Prophet said. There's nothing wrong with that. But what is lacking is we don't tend to study what he did. This, you can say, is the absent, the active, absent component of the seerah. We don't study what he did. This is what is required in concentrating our minds on what the Prophet did. Analyzing what he did. Because we say actions speak louder than words. Okay, what were the Prophet's actions? Let us focus our mind and our thoughts on his actions. And give this some balance at least. A lot of people, you'll go to Jumu'ah prayers, you'll go to lectures on Islam. The Prophet said this, the Prophet said that, the Prophet said, okay, fine. As I said, no one is arguing anything the Prophet said. But please, give this a semblance of balance. Tell us what the Prophet did. And don't stop there. Analyze for us what the Prophet did. That's what we need when we read the seerah and when we write the seerah. Please tell me what the Prophet did and what it meant at that time and how we can transfer that meaning to our time. That is what is needed. So the next time you go to a masjid or you go to an Islamic conference or you tune into a khutbah, try to think, is the person just saying what the Prophet said, or is he trying to explain to me in understandable terms and in practical and relevant meanings what the Prophet did? I hope on that note I have communicated. Actually, I came with I thought that maybe, you know, to make up for past truncated presentations, I'll be given some time to go into much more details that I have. I actually have, sometimes many of you ask, at least me, I've encountered this question many times, could you actually tell us the name of those 50-odd individuals who were the core of that initial stage of Islamic da'wah at the time of the Prophet's first 3 years? And I have their names. I actually obtained their names and have them written down. But just reading them will take about, I don't know, 5 or 8 minutes or so, especially if you want to comment a little about who they are. And I had some other, much other details about the stages of the Prophet Seerah, but inshallah we'll leave that maybe to another occasion. Please, if I have made some type of inaccurate statement, it's your responsibility to bring it to my attention. This is not a contest here where I'm trying to, you know, present some ideas and satisfy an ego or something like that. We are here to try to work together in the spirit of Allah's Prophet. It just sometimes, you know, I don't know, you know, human beings, we all have our soft spots. But sometimes in the privacy of my own self, if I just remember the Prophet's hand, I become emotional. I don't know why. I hope we've related to you some of what he stood for. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.